You're listening to Serious Inquiries Only.
Hello and welcome to Serious Inquiries Only. This is episode 157. And today I am happy to bring you an interview with Dr. Sarah Taber. She's a scientist. She's an expert in sustainable agriculture. She does inspections. She does consulting. And she's got a lot of cool stuff to teach us about food safety, sustainability. And you might learn some pretty interesting counterintuitive stuff here. For example, how she feels about farmers markets, the artisanal movement, who should shoulder the burden for making agriculture more sustainable, and get behind the process of how she goes about her work and how she notices when things might be amiss on a particular farm. It's very interesting, and let's get right over to it. I'm joined by Dr. Sarah Taber. How are you doing?
So good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm really excited to talk to you. I love the name of your podcast, Farm to Taber. It's
Thank you. It was someone else's idea, but you know, it's good to recognize when it happens.
Right. Yeah. Well, okay. You're very fair. You got to give, you know, credit where it's due, but I thought it was hilarious. And also I'm excited to talk about sustainable agriculture and all that. But first, I'm wondering if you could give the listeners a bit of your background, a bit of a introduction to who you are.
Sure. So I'm Dr. Sarah Taber. I'm a crop scientist, and I originally got into crop science on account of I love plants. They're nice. they're quiet. They're chill. You know, yeah. Like they just want to do what they're going to do.
Except that Venus flytrap. That's the only one that's really...
You know, they do what they want to do too.
Yeah, that's true.
They know what they're about and they just do it.
Yeah.
So that was kind of what I got into it for, was just I really like plants. And then come to find out, you get a little further into it professionally and you realize that in order to take care of the plants, you have to take care of the people who take care of the plants. So you get into something because you like plants and then it all winds up being people. So that's life, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, so a lot of what I do now, you know, I started out in crop science and then I started doing a lot of food safety. And food safety is really interesting because a lot of folks really think it's about, you know, like techniques and practices. It's about washing your hands. It's about, you know, SOPs and all that stuff. And that's in there. But what food safety is really about is about human systems. It's about making sure that socially people are aware of what they're supposed to be doing, that there's accountability, and that the folks at the top of the organization are doing what they're supposed to be doing. The folks at the bottom, you know, like, you know, they're at the bottom of the organization. Organizations are already pretty good at telling them what they need to be doing, but it's holding the folks at the top accountable that's really challenging. So that's kind of what food safety is all about. It's actually about people. It's about human systems. So that's kind of where I've been tilting a little bit in my work is, you know, we need to understand human systems. You know, they're real, they're important, and they're actually behind a lot of what has made agriculture so not sustainable in the past. And in order to really make it more positive and more sustainable, we have to pay attention not just to our techniques like composting and cover crops and all that, but we have to pay attention to human systems. So
that's really fascinating. So it's one of those things where you think like, oh, I'm gonna find the scientific solution to this problem, or it's gonna be based on, you know, something like that. Right. But then it sounds as though when you get into it, it's like, oh wait, people just aren't doing the things that
they need to be doing. Scientific solutions are just kind of a pipe dream without people who can do them. So yeah.
Wow, that's both depressing and fascinating. it's sort of like that. I think it was an Onion headline from a while ago that's like, scientists remind us sustainable technology is here whenever we want to use it. Essentially,
pretty much, yeah. And I mean, it can be depressing. Not gonna lie, but you also do run into companies and farms that are actually doing things the way they're supposed to be doing them, and their management's actually responsible. And you're like, wow, this is really amazing. And like the morale at those companies is always good because, you know, management's doing what they need to be doing instead of being negligent. And there's a different feel to those operations. You can almost feel it. Like as soon as you walk on, you kind of know what kind of day it's going to be. Mm. So the ones that are having a hard time are just, you know, really challenging and really difficult for, you know, I'm just there for, you know, maybe a couple of days, but the folks who work there all the time, like, they got some morale issues because they're getting pissed on by management all the time. But the places where management's doing what they need to be doing, like, they feel good. And you always learn a lot from those guys about how to do things right. So that's been really, really cool.
Yeah. So are you're in a position where you're auditing farms, or what's, can you describe that interaction you're talking about?
Yeah. I kind of do two lines of business. One is auditing and one is consulting. And auditing, I just subcontract through a food safety auditing company. It's not government. I tell people I'm not from the government and I'm not here to help, but they never think that's funny. That's through a company. So it's kind of like organic certification, where if you want to sell to a certain buyer and they expect you to have organic or say food safety certification, then you just call up a company that does that and you say, come check me out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that's kind of one side of the business. And the other half is training and coaching and consulting for food safety. So if you're a company that needs to get audited and you want to make sure that everything goes right the first time, then you call somebody like me and we kind of walk you through that process.
But this is interesting that it sounds like that's all private sector kind of stuff. There's not.
It really is.
How does that strike you? Doesn't seem like, I mean, should the government have some hand in being like, hey, is the food safe, everybody?
Yeah. So we're kind of unique because that's the produce, right? So if you're meat, dairy, eggs, I think even to some extent bakeries, you have government oversight.
Oh,
so
okay.
It could be the county health department or it could be the USDA, just depending on the scale, if you're moving food across state lines, that kind of thing. But produce never really got any kind of government oversight until like 2009.
Wow.
Because, yeah, there just hadn't really been any problems really associated with it. We hadn't been causing outbreaks until pretty recently, or at least they hadn't been getting caught. I think this is more the case, is they just hadn't been getting caught.
Yeah, I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I feel like it was always sprouts were like stuff of that. And
sprouts
then what was the lettuce
disgusting.
One? Yeah. What is it about like sprouts? They just have bad hygiene or what?
You know, they have to basically grow them in like warm water.
And
salmonella just likes the same environment. So if you have like any shred of salmonella contamination, it's just going to multiply really fast.
Yeah.
It's like they're kind of warm and it's not as bright. They're indoors. So like if you have lettuce growing out there in the field, it's usually in California or Arizona or somewhere where it's hot and dry. And so, you know, they would water them with like overhead sprinklers using kind of grungy canal water, but it was also in a desert, so it would dry up right away.
Yeah.
And there's just like so much UV radiation that the bacteria didn't really have a chance to multiply. So I don't want to say that's fine. We definitely still had outbreaks tied to that, but it's been nowhere near as bad as sprouts, just because sprouts are like warm and they're sheltered and they're indoors. So everything has a chance to go wild in a way it doesn't necessarily outside. So that's sprouts.
Yeah.
Where were we? Regulatory.
Sorry,
oversight?
I find that very interesting. Yeah, you're talking about the, you know, how much outbreaks that have been resulted from produce versus meat. And so that's besides sprouts and gosh, what was the recent romaine or was it?
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, it seems like historically it's been safer. So that's why there hasn't been as much government regulation.
I don't know if I want to say safer, you know, because that's really kind of gone on a limb, right?
Sure.
But it's not as risky. we just had those bad E. coli outbreaks in 2006 with the spinach, and there were a couple other things that kind of made people go, oh, this is actually a category of food that can have problems. It has just never been on the radar before.
Mm.
The Food Safety Modernization Act of 2009 was kind of formed in response to that. But long before, we call it FSMA, you know, Food Safety Modernization Act, but long before FSMA was passed, grocery stores had been noticing that they were getting outbreaks from produce. And your average grocery chain or grocery store is hit with like 50 recalls a week. Like that's
wow.
A lot. Yeah, that's just a lot to deal with when you have like, you know, like a stocking crew that's got a high school education kind of situation and just keeping everything straight. It's just a big hassle for the grocery stores. And so they started going, look, we're going to handle this through the supply chain. If you want to sell to us, you need to pass an audit. And by no means have they like prevented every single outbreak from happening, but the number of outbreaks has actually gone down significantly. Once the store starts using that audit system, they start getting less outbreaks. So, yeah, that's entirely private. That's just supply chain.
How about that free market? Apparently it can help sometimes.
Yeah, well, there's also a free market for diploma mills.
Yeah.
So that's the challenge as an auditor is, okay, in terms of my appetite for risk, I want to make sure that if I'm working with a company that's doing certifications, if I go to a farm and it's disgusting and I give them a report that says this place is disgusting, I don't want the company that I'm working for going behind my back and issuing them a certificate anyway. I don't want to work for a company that's going to give me pressure like, oh, come on, we really need to keep this client and they want to be happy.
Yeah.
Because I've worked for some other companies besides the one I'm with right now, because the company that I'm with is the first one I started working with. And they actually do QA. Like, they actually want their clients to be up to the standard that they say they're at. So I assumed everybody works that way, but they do not. I started working with another one subcontracting briefly, and I went to a few facilities and I was like, get me the fuck out of here. I think I see what's going on here. It's disgusting. So, you know.
Well, now I got to ask. I mean, as I assume you are an eater of food, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
I guess I shouldn't make assumptions. Do you eat food? No.
More or less,
as a consumer of food, what are the kinds of things you're thinking when you've peeked behind the curtain here? Do you get weirded out by it? Are you kind of like, oh, it is what it is? What are your feelings as a food consumer?
You know, the only food I've really been put off from is Sprouts, and I hated Sprouts anyway. I just don't enjoy putting them in my mouth, so that was like an excuse, really. I know there's a lot of folks in food safety who have just like this long list of things they won't eat anymore.
Wow.
And I'm kind of one of those, the cobbler's kids are always barefoot kind of people, I guess. I'm like, I'm always thinking about food safety at work. If I'm not at work, I don't want to be worrying about it. You know, if you see something obviously disgusting, you don't eat it, but I'm not also wanting to really just be in that mindset all the time. So
there's no like category of food where you've seen, I've seen too many horrific farms or whatever it is, so I'm not going to eat this, besides Sprouts, but you don't like Sprouts.
I definitely see some things where I'm like, okay, if I'm going to eat that, it's going to be washed or it's going to be cooked, you know, okay. But it's not like I'm never eating it.
Right. Well, it seems like you got to wash your produce anyway, right?
Yeah. I mean, it depends on the product. Like, there's a lot of things where washing it won't do you a whole lot of good. Like lettuce and leafy greens are just really tough to wash because right. There's so much surface area there. And even in the best situation, washing can only remove 99% of the crap that's on there. And you think, well, 99%, that's pretty good. And you're like, well, not if there were 10,000 salmonella on it to start with, right?
I guess, I don't know the units of salmonella that are bad. I guess 1,000 salmonella is still bad. Or that would be 100 salmonella. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, like washing can take 99% off and folks think, wow, that sounds good. But it's, I mean, if it's really dirty, the washing's not going to help you out. Oh, wow. So a lot of what they do for washing in the produce industry is actually just to remove like physical debris, like dirt and sticks and cigarette butts that may have been in the field.
Yeah.
That's actually what the washing is for. And while we're doing that, removing physical debris, we need to make sure that we're just not, you know, if there's a clump of lettuce or something that was gross, that we're not spreading that grossness around. So we'll put antimicrobials in the water like, you know, sodium hypochlorite, or if you're an organic operation, they can use Sanidade and some other like organic certified antimicrobials in your water just to keep it from spreading around. You're not going to get rid of it on the one piece of lettuce that was gross, but at least you can keep it from spreading around.
What, following up on that, though, what are the kinds of, I don't know, what are a few common things that you might see or that you're looking for as a food safety expert to say, oh, this is a bad situation. You don't want this.
Right. Man, I wish I didn't have to say this, but just like straight up illegal activity.
Oh, wow.
That's only happened a couple of times.
So they need to give you a badge and a gun, I think. And then there should be a movie about you.
I mean, yeah. Diarrhea Hunter. You know, so some Old West sounds. But, I mean, we've had a couple of times when people found really wild stuff going on in the facility. We've had a time or two when a farm just wouldn't let you into a certain closet or storage area. And, I mean, we have to go check all the parts out because if you have a rodent problem in there, then it can spread everywhere, right? You know, and they're always like, well, there's no food in here. Well, it doesn't matter because if there's rodents in there, they're getting in your food. So we've had a couple of times when a farm would not let you in somewhere. And you're like, okay, well, just so you know, like you're going to fail the audit if you don't let me in there. And they're like, that's fine. Wow. So I always kind of go away from those spots. You know, you finish out the paperwork, you know, everybody signs to confirm they canceled the audit. And you always kind of drive away going like, what were they smuggling?
Yeah, well, I just assume they're all growing marijuana, right? They got some sort of... That's what
I would assume. It was a darker closet than that would have really worked for, and I didn't smell any weed, so I'm like, it's either meth or people. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's horrifying. Well, that's horrifying illegal stuff. But what are some basics that even if you haven't encountered somebody violating this, what are you looking for? Like checking off your list.
Right. Okay. So this is kind of something that is funny to me as a farm inspector, because a lot of folks will say things like, well, if you've been to the farm, then you know, right? Hmm. But there's a lot of signs of stuff that's happened that you're not going to see unless you kind of have been trained to see it and you know what a normal operational farm looks like. So Just if everything is kind of broken and everything's kind of grimy, you know, that's pretty obvious. Another one is like water damage on certain things. Like if you see water damage in a cooler, then you know that there's, you know, especially if it's on, say, the ceiling of a cooler, which I've seen before. If you see water damage on the ceiling of a cooler, you know that it may not be happening right now, but you know in the past there has been like water raining off the ceiling into produce. And that's disgusting. So
it sounds like water is the enemy. Like you need water, but yeah. If you got water in the wrong time and place, then that's really bad for...
You know, it's never just water, right? There's always something in it, so... Yeah. So that's kind of a big thing, is you want to look out for water. It's just know where it's coming from, see where it's going. And if you see water where it doesn't belong, that's kind of a big red flag.
Okay.
So that's a big one. And it's not always there in the moment when you're at the facility, but you can kind of see signs. You can, you know, see tracks and stuff like that.
Right.
Something that I've kind of found, and it's really hard to define, but again, like the emotional tempo of the operation. I mean, that's not data. You know, you can't make any judgments just based off of that, but it does kind of tell you may have something to look for or what exactly to look for.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Like if you've ever read Anna Karenina, you know, it's like every happy family is the same and every unhappy family is unhappy for different reasons kind of deal.
Hmm.
And I feel like farms and manufacturing facilities are almost that way too. Like the ones that are working and clicking, like they feel right. They've got a certain feel to them. You know, they're busy. They might be a little stressed out, but it's like the good kind of stressed out, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah.
And ones that are not clicking and something ain't right in there. Typically, like food safety problems come from management neglect. And negligent management is going to neglect a lot of things, not just food safety. So there's worker safety problems. So the workers know they're in danger and management doesn't give a fuck. All right. That's going to show up in your morale.
Well, this is so fascinating. So it's down the line of what you said, where it's like, here you thought you were going to be, I don't know, using some Ghostbusters type instrument to measure plants. And then it turns out you're just gauging people. And like, you have to be like this savant in terms of, you know, judging the room. And that's so funny. I never would have thought that.
Right. You got to use your heart.
Yeah.
It's your highest piece of technology.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. Like if you can feel it and you don't always know exactly what's wrong, but you kind of know there's something. And so you kind of, you know, keep an eye out and keep your ears open.
That makes perfect sense though, because like, I'm sure most people listening can relate to that shitty job they had somewhere. And it's like the whole, you know, nobody cares, you know, the bad morale or you're not, you know, there's going to be, you can feel it. It's not going to be a good operation.
Yeah. It's not a good vibe. And it's hard to put a finger on it, but I've kind of talked to some other food safety people at very major companies, like major grocery chains. And I'm like, so this happened once. And they're like, oh yeah, if you feel something ain't right, that's important. Pay attention to that.
That's so interesting. So I really like that. It's so funny that you just wouldn't have thought like, it's a scientist thing. And a lot of what you're doing is really based on kind of intuition and feel. But I guess that's how people work.
Well, I mean, you can't make a final decision based on that, right?
Right. Yeah,
again,
of course.
It's not data, but it can kind of guide you as you're going around.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. You're not putting on the report, got a weird vibe. You're just using that to indicate that maybe you need to take a
line one. Yeah. I don't know. This place just kind of sketched me out. I don't know why. Yeah, you can't do that. But again, like sometimes when you drive into a place, I found there's a correlation between if a place's parking lot is really chaotic and sketchy, the inside is not going to be any better. Which sounds really dumb, but like parking lot logistics are actually really important for a facility that has lots of trucks coming in and out, right?
Right.
Like you need to have your spot for employees to park and you need to have like lanes for semis to come through that are big enough and that kind of needs to be ordered and everyone needs to know what's going on. So that requires communication and that requires management to have a plan. And if they can't have a plan for basic stuff like getting trucks in and out, you know the inside's a wreck, right?
Well, so much of this stuff you would think, or one would think, would be inherited or learned over the decades. I mean, farming is a pretty old thing. No.
Yeah, there was actually a really interesting book that came out a week or two ago by a historian who started out her career as a business analyst at McKinsey & Co. and later became a historian. So she does business history. And she did a lot of really interesting work and traced, how do you say, American business management culture, like, you know, our traditions of how we think of labor and how we account for the cost of labor and all that. So the place where all of that developed was slave plantations. And boy, you can tell. Like, there's a pretty direct line, which is really interesting because I'd kind of been seeing a lot of those same trends in agriculture. Just the farms that operate the best are the ones that treat their people the best. And that being the case, you would wonder why so many operations treat their workers so badly. Clearly, there's another influence going on here besides actual profit motive. And there's just a lot of emotional baggage that the U.S. management class has not sorted through since 1862.
Wow.
So, yeah, kind of gross and fascinating. But this was something, again, I'd kind of been wondering. And then this, you know, very well-researched book by a historian comes out like a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
So I'm eating that one up, you know.
That's really cool. You know, I kind of was wondering if we can transition because you mentioned organic. I'd love to get your thoughts on organic. I've had a few scientists on here in the past, and I kind of can't really make up my mind. I mean, my impression has been that it kind of seems like a label that isn't all that meaningful and allows people to just charge a lot for something. but I don't know. Yeah. I could be wrong. Let me know.
Yeah, it depends. And I have a lot of mixed feelings on it because, you know, like as we kind of been talking, the thing that I noticed that really makes a difference and makes or break an operation in terms of sustainability is how it treats people. And organic has nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
So it's a little orthogonal to what I do.
Oh, just for anybody who's not familiar and I need to brush up myself, what's the actual, you know, dictionary definition of what it means to be organic?
I don't know. They've changed the rules a bit since I was really paying attention last.
Oh, okay.
They kind of update the regs every once in a while. I think they didn't used to require dairy to be pasture fed, and now it is, but I don't know if that's like 80% pasture fed, 80% of the time, 80% of the actual food they eat. I don't know.
Well, we won't, you know, we're not going to grade you like it's a test. We'll just take the broad strokes of what it just means, not using certain chemicals and not use, right? Is it that kind of thing?
Yeah, actually, no. So
no? Okay.
That's another like a big bone thorn in the side of the organic community is they believe that they're all about soil health, right? It's about the soil. And I really think soil health kind of evolved as shorthand for just having a long-term viewpoint. And that kind of got boiled down to it's all about the soil. But again, taking care of your soil health doesn't do shit for people necessarily. So I don't think it's the whole picture. But what consumers think it means, so what the organic movement and the sustainability activists, they think it means soil health. What consumers think it means is no pesticides. So organic operations can actually use quite a bit of pesticides. They're just special organic pesticides. And I mean, it's funny because every once in a while, I mean, well, pretty frequently when you're working with an organic operation, they'll really have this attitude that like, well, I can dump my pesticides when I'm done with them because they're safe. And you're like, no, dude, they still kill things. That's literally why you're using them. Yeah. So I've seen some really interesting, irresponsible
behavior. Plus it's organic, so you can probably drink those pesticides too. I mean,
no,
it's organic,
no,
it's
you really shouldn't. They still work. That's the point, right?
Yeah.
So it's really interesting because on the one hand, like it really does have a lot of the markings of just kind of a marketing situation. On the other hand, it actually has created a market for better agricultural techniques. So there was really never demand for better ways to do things. So nobody ever really did the research and developed the products to do it. So from that count, I think it's been very successful. It's actually created a place to use better techniques. I mean, I think that's really been its big strength. I'm not a Whole Foods shopper. You know, like I work in agriculture, so I live and I work in rural areas and we don't have Whole Foods here. It's, you know, and we were very poor. We were in graduate school with a child for a very long time. So the life of buy all your food organic is just, even to this day, is still very foreign to me. It's interesting because I work in agriculture and I work in sustainable agriculture, but the, I think what you think of as sustainable lifestyle thing, I don't do that. Because like, I don't know, it's when you work on the inside of the business, you're like, oh yeah, this really isn't designed to be accessible to everybody. So I'm not going to freak out about it. Like, this is not for me.
Yeah. Yeah. There does seem to be a tendency sometimes to put a whole lot of burden on individual people to somehow solve massive problems. And I guess, you know, if it is something where, you know, if we all did X, then it would be fine. But sometimes it's not that. Sometimes it's like, well, you know, when it comes to, I don't know, water usage, like we can take a shorter shower all we want, and then that'll do nothing because the majority of water is used in agriculture, that kind of thing, where it's like, you know, how much of a difference can we make? But if we, you know, if we can make a difference, it'd be good to try. So what do you think? I guess I also want to ask, what are the main challenges of sustainable agriculture? I mean, if I am just naively thinking, you know, what's the issue? We can just grow stuff forever. Seems fine to me. What are the basic problems?
Well, I think you kind of hit it on the head there is a lot of folks are thinking of it as a B2C problem, like it's business to consumer and consumers are supposed to fix it. And really it's a B2B problem. Business owners are supposed to fix it because they're the ones making decisions at the scale that can actually affect this kind of stuff. So I'll give you a really good example. Like you mentioned shorter showers, like you live in California, so you're going to take shorter showers to save the world, except most of the water in California by far is used for irrigating crops.
Yeah.
So I'll give you an example. California's got a ton of almonds growing there now. Or if you're a California almond grower, you're pronouncing almonds. So there's a ton of almonds out there.
I hear people say almonds a lot. They just leave out the L.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. It's down here at pecans or pecans, you know, it's the same deal, I guess. But yeah, so you have a ton of almonds growing out there, just like square miles of almonds, and they take a ton of irrigation. And so that a lot of that is because of a demand for nut milk, basically, right? And nut products. But there's a lot of nuts out there. Why is it all almonds and why is it all in California? Hmm. So for example, down here in the South, being a sustainable ag person based in the South is kind of interesting because the South really should be the breadbasket of the country. We have a long growing season and tons of water, right? What went wrong? What happened? Why are we not doing that? So, for example, pecans, like this demand for nut milk and nut products, a lot of that could be met with pecans. But we're not doing that because in order to plant a pecan grove, you need to, it takes like 5 to 10 years for them to mature, right? So you have to get a loan for 5 to 10 years that's going to cover your costs. And that kind of agricultural capital is just not financed in the South. We just don't do that down here.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So I take it almonds are quicker to kind of get the turnover and get and actually be able to pay off that loan.
Yes, but so you have to grow them in California because they need dry weather. You know, they can't handle humidity, whereas pecans can, right? So they have to be grown in California. The ag land in California is easily $30,000 to $60,000 an acre, whereas in North Carolina, it's $3,000 to $6,000 an acre. Yeah. So it takes the trees twice as long to mature here, but the land also costs a tenth as much. So it kind of pencils out.
Yeah. So why isn't that happening then?
Because we don't do that kind of financing down here. We just don't do it. Agriculture down here is seriously undercapitalized. There is one bank that finances just about all the agriculture in the Netherlands. Like they're good at investing in agriculture out there. And they have a lot of branches in the U.S., but they're all in California. I think they just really haven't seen any gain for them in expanding outside of California because that's where people who grow are more professional. So there's been this really positive feedback cycle in California where the growers are professional. So the financing is there. So there's a point in being professional and then there's more financing. And we've just never done that here in the South.
Wow.
So there's this tremendous market opportunity with nut products that we've just never done. Like you go driving through the South and there's a few places that have bigger nut groves, but by and large, they kind of max out at like 2 acres. And it's kind of like, we had a couple $100 left over after the cotton harvest this year. So we're going to plant a couple pecan trees in the backyard to make shade. And then also sometimes we'll pick them up and sell them. Like that's where it's at in the South. That's where our level of intensity is at.
But I'm surprised that, so then I guess what surprises me about that though, is it just seems like if this is such a no-brainer that some sort of corporation that already has resources to buy what's essentially really cheap land in the grand scheme of things. I'm just surprised that hasn't happened. Like it seems like an enormous business
opportunity.
Oh, it's
totally happened.
Okay.
So, you know, folks in California who really do the high-end ag, you'll hear tale of them coming out to North Carolina or Georgia every once in a while. Like they'll come out here. They're like, land is cheap. There's all this water. I'm going to set me up. I'm going to farm. And they come screaming back to California within 5 years. They can't make it out here.
Why is that?
Believe it or not, California and the South are kind of different. So farmers in the California Central Valley, like I think they think they're country and then they actually come out here and they're like, holy shit, I can't take this.
Oh, like literally they just don't want to be there?
Yeah, I think that's some extent part of it.
But you could also, I mean, you could, if you're a corporation with all this money, you know, you could set up an operation, hire people locally, don't you think?
Again, all I know is folks have tried it and never seems to work out, right? Yeah. And I think a big part of that is, so I was going on to how California and the South are mm-hmm. different. A big part of that is I think folks who don't farm think that farming works like everything is done in-house, right? Farmer Bob wakes up, Farmer Bob does his chores, Farmer Bob goes to bed. How agriculture actually works in California is a farm is really more like a general contractor. And all the tasks on the farm, like a lot of them are pretty specialized. And so there are companies out there that you hire to come and do specific gigs like, hey, these guys plant trees. You use specialized equipment for that. And if you're a farm, you're only doing that like maybe once a year max. So why would you buy that specialized equipment? Just hire a crew to come do it. You know, nut harvest can kind of be the same way. A lot of your agricultural tasks, you know, in California are hired out to specialized contractors. And again, the farmer is really just like a general contractor.
So is a lot of the infrastructure not quite there to try to do all that?
Yes. California-style farming really relies on having this entire network. So that's kind of, again, we're getting to human systems. Sustainable agriculture really relies on an entire network of really knowledgeable, really skilled, well-capitalized people. And we don't have that down here. And so I think that's actually a big part of why California land prices are so high is the actual cost of doing business is somewhat decreased because there's so many skilled contractors out there. Hmm. Whereas out here, the land is cheap, but you have to do everything yourself. You have to own all your own equipment. So I think growers who come out here are just, it's interesting because when you audit folks, like they just, what they see around them, they think is normal. And I like to kind of tell California farmers about the dumb shit we see down here. And it just blows their mind. They're like, you know, they're surrounded by regulations. And because everybody's so professional, they don't necessarily see the reason for the regulations. And out here, we don't have them at all. So crazy shit's happening all the time.
Oh, and, wow. You know, you can just you give us a quick example of craziest thing you've seen?
I've seen small family farms like poison their workers by improper chemical use.
Wow.
Yeah, it was the kind where it can poison somebody short term, and if you keep doing it wrong, you can explode your facility. And I was like, guys, it's right here in the MSDS sheet. Did you see that they can explode your facility? And they're like, oh my God. I was like, dude, it's right there. It's in English.
So we started this by talking about sustainability and sustainable agriculture. And I think were you leading into, you know, almonds are the short term thing, but are they longer term not as sustainable? Because was that what you were getting at?
Well, no, it's just that unsustainable things maybe happen because, or you know, regardless of sustainability, California actually has the financing to do things, period. And the South does not. And maybe the South would do a better job at it and the South could do it sustainably, but we don't because we don't have the human capital infrastructure here. So I think that's kind of the big thing that folks forget is an issue in sustainability is the human factor is so huge. You know, we're really focused on techniques. But we don't think about the human systems that support actually executing them.
Right. But I guess we haven't, maybe this is too basic so that it's not even occurring to you to lay out, but what is the problem? Like if, you know, is it running out of water? Is it running out of something in the soil? Is it, you know, when you talk about sustainability, yes, it sounds like you've described things aren't set up optimally, but what are you optimizing and what are the dangers, I guess?
Well, I mean, it's what you're optimizing for is going to be different in every situation. So like in California, there's not a lot of water, so you should optimize for water use. In the South, we have probably too much water. So you want to optimize for different things. And that's part of the difficulty is, you know, like anything with people and anything with biology and then anything with both of them, like farming, what you need to optimize for is going to be really dependent on where you are and what you're doing. So I think folks always look for rules of thumb and there aren't any. The only rule of thumb is there are no rules of thumb. And I think that's what people find really challenging is they're always looking for an answer or the answer. And there is no the answer. That is the challenge.
To what? I mean, I still, again, what is the issue here? What is the danger? Like what is sustainable agriculture? I still don't feel like we've gotten to the heart of the problem unless I'm just really not understanding it.
I mean, you can just keep growing food and not like destroy the environment.
Right. So what is it that's destroying?
Actually grow enough food for people to eat that is meeting nutritional needs and also provides like actual livelihoods that provide, you know, upward mobility.
Right. So what is it that's destroying the environment, I guess, would be like in give me an example.
So like, for example, in California, it's kind of been plowed flat and everything so long ago that it's like, I don't know if you want to say this is destroying the environment because everything's already been flattened. It's already like that. But there's just, you know, there's not enough water to go around. So that's less an issue of destroying the environment per se, and more just like we can't keep farming there at that intensity forever.
Okay.
So I think I want to emphasize when people think sustainable agriculture, they're thinking 100% environment, and there's actually a lot more factors. There's human factors.
Okay.
There's just, can we actually sustain it economically in this area on this crop, that kind of stuff.
I see. So it's, yeah, not necessarily like the world is ending. It's just different components that you want to be able to sustain for a lengthy period of time.
Yeah. I mean, just, you know, and sustainable, I think, is kind of like the, it's like the old word now. And the new thing we're trying to do is regenerative agriculture, where it's like sustainable is like, we can just keep doing this. And regenerative is like, we actually rebuild. So like an example of that might be grass-fed livestock, because that does good things for the soil. If you can rotate land between crops and growing grass for just livestock, that can do good things for it. Your crop yields are better. So that's an example of a technique that's not just sustainable, but it's also regenerative, yada, yada. But you kind of get the idea. They're all kind of pointing in the same direction.
I see. So let me ask you this then. What are you most worried about going forward? I mean, obviously, you know, we got climate change and all that, but in terms of your, what you study and what you do, what are the problems that you, that most worry you or most keep you up at night going forward?
What keeps me up at night is the folks. Okay. So we have certain problems in agriculture, and the mainstream agriculture sector has actually been fairly good at addressing a lot of these issues. Cause they've been getting a lot of pressure for a couple of decades now, but you get the sustainable agriculture sector that, number one, doesn't notice that any of that is going on. Number two, there's a lot of great lessons for mainstream ag that they're not taking because they're like, mainstream ag is evil and I don't want to learn any of their stuff because then I might be tainted. And then the third thing is the tech industry is getting into food and it's fucking terrifying. Because the tech industry is all, it's, you know, it's either software or finance people, basically. That's a symbols manipulation job. Food is a real object. They behave differently. There's no like backspace if you fuck it up with food. And there's also just a really certain kind of like neglect of human systems. So again, if you're dealing with anything with actual physical object logistics, you need to have your human systems down tight because, again, there's no backspace, right? And human systems is just something that the finance and software sectors have no clue exists. And so they don't even know how much they don't know. So having worked in a few projects in that area, it's really kind of like making my hair stand on end a little bit. Like I've had some clients in that area who are great and they're getting their stuff together. And the ones that are bad are so bad and so well-funded, they will never die.
Right. It's people, it's like Elon Musk is coming around with a bajillion dollars and thinking he's going to re-engineer everything in the world when it comes to is it stuff like that where people from another
industry.
Yeah,
it's industry Tesla with food. It's yeah that's yeah. Exactly what it is.
You said a moment ago too, something that really resonates with me is this paranoia about any sort of corporation or anything that seems like it's, you know, associated with being bad can never be part of a solution for some people.
Yeah.
Like some people just think that way and doesn't.
Yeah.
Doesn't
and that's,
seem
that's
right.
Kind of disheartening because I feel like anything that is truly ambitious and worth doing, you can't do alone now. Right. So that's kind of what the artisanal movement is all about. Is like, oh, it's small groups of people just kind of doing their own thing. And you're like, you're really kind of limited in what you can accomplish. Like doing hard stuff takes a lot of people. And I think in some ways, the artisanal movement is actually really cynical. It's like, look, we can't do anything together. Why bother? Hmm. Like there's no point in people trying to work together.
So is this the idea of like everybody just growing a couple fruits and vegetables on their own or something? Or what's, how do you define the artisanal?
Or just like, I feel like small is beautiful is kind of the four legs good, two legs bad of food right now. Hmm. You know, it's a credo that's really easy to remember and just completely inaccurate. And it stops us from thinking, okay, like we need to scale. You need to have food at scale. Like just the fact that stuff is more affordable at scale, that's real. And if you can't deal with it, then you don't give a fuck about poor people. That's all there is to it.
Right, right.
That's just the way it is.
Do you find a lot of this to be tied up in class, you know, in a way that people who have the time and the money to kind of think a certain way about these things are not quite seeing the full picture?
Yeah. And I think to some extent, kind of the food movement is less about, quote unquote, healing the world and fixing things. And it's more just about building walled gardens for rich people, which, you know, I just don't feel good about. So that's been a challenge, especially someone who has been really broke for a long time. You know, things are better now. that I've got a business up and going. But having spent so much time broke, you could kind of see exactly how much the food movement actually cared. And it was not a good look.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Can you give me an example? Sorry, I keep putting you on the spot, but do you have a good example of anything that you're seeing in these movements where people think this is a great idea, but actually counterintuitively it's not? Do you have anything off the top of your head?
Yeah. So farmer's markets, a classic example
of
like
farmer's market coming in hard on farmer's market. Who doesn't love farmer's market? I can't wait to hear this take. Do it. Let's go. I love it.
Okay. So I'll just kind of give you a scenario. You know, I'm in graduate school.
Okay.
I am taking a full course load. I am also working a job and I have a daughter that I'm nursing. So, you know, everything is time sensitive, right? So, but farmers markets, you know, and this is what you're supposed to do if you're a young professional mom, is you're supposed to only feed your baby organic food and all that stuff. And you're like supposed to go to farmers markets and shit. Well, the farmers market was in the middle of the day on a Wednesday, on a weekday, when that's when we had childcare. So you better be working. And the food quality at farmers markets, I know everybody says it's good and that may depend on your market, but at this one, it certainly was not. It was in the middle of the day in the South and there was no shade and all the food was very hot. And, you know, you'd get some peaches and they looked great. And when, you know, 12 hours later, when you woke up in the morning, they'd already turned into brown mush because they'd been hot for so long.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was kind of, you know, an experience that I had. And, you know, the peaches were overpriced and they were small and then they rotted like immediately. And that was like the one day when I was like, okay, I really need to like pull up my shorts on this whole mom thing and just like go get some good food and then it rots on you, you know.
I know, and that's the worst. I can sympathize. I also have a 1-year-old right now. Yeah. And that makes it harder for you. If you buy something thinking you've got your food figured out for the next however many days and then it's just gone.
Yeah, like just to make our life work, we had to get there very specific slots in the week that we had to go grocery shopping, and the farmer's market was not scheduled around those. So you have to have like not just disposable income, but disposable time.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing the food movement really does not respect, is that poor people also don't have time, like especially the working poor, they've always got 2 or 3 jobs. The food movement, I really think, is kind of built around like getting a hold of good food that is inaccessible by nature is like this badge of honor. And that's the way it's supposed to work. Like that's what you do to show how much you care and that you're really into it. And it's such a rich person's game, you know,
so true.
It's just bullshit. Like it's a status symbol. That's it. Like that's why sustainable food in a lot of ways exists right now, is to serve as a status symbol. And if we're building food movements, we're accessing hard to get stuff serves as a status symbol, and that's why we're doing it, and that's what we're building our human systems around, it is not going to work for anybody except for a few very elite people. And so when I say that it's really kind of about building a walled garden so folks can feel good about themselves, that's kind of what I'm getting at there.
Wow. Yeah, no, I think you put that really well. It does seem to be this status symbol where you notice like the currency, you know, the kind of the social currency involved with some groups, where it's, if you found something, you know, the harder it was to get something and the more, you know, then that kind of seems as though you've accomplished something. But I think it makes perfect sense what you're pointing out, which is, well, that's the worst way it should be. We need to make it so these things are easier if they're good for the environment, if they're good for sustainable agriculture. We need to make sure it's easier to get, not harder.
Yeah. And just the thing is, like, it's kind of harder to build those systems that actually wrap around to everybody. It's hard. And I think that's a lot of why we haven't been wanting to do it, is we want to do this artisanal, like, you know, easy to wrap your head around it kind of thing. And that's just not going to exist. And I mean, folks who are into food, and if people want to spend their time getting difficult to reach food and that's their thing, that's fine. That's a hobby. That's great. Mm-hmm. You should not have to build your life around getting healthy food to get healthy food. The healthy food should be normal. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. It's like the same reason I don't blame people who have to shop at Walmart kind of thing. It's like, if you can't afford anything else, I don't think it's your responsibility to spend more money when you don't have it. That kind of thing.
And where, time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I think that's kind of the thing, is we kind of take that whole burden of making the food system work and we push it on people who don't have those resources. And it's tremendously just disrespectful.
So that's then what beef. Do you think we can do? Like, so what if the answer is not that, what do you think the answer, if anything, is for people like, I don't know, me, for just everyday people who would like to see something change, but, you know, not sure what to do?
Right. So here's the thing. I think we've kind of been told by the sustainable food movement that it is the job of ordinary people like us and consumers to fix it. And I don't think it is. I think it's business owners' job to fix it.
All right. So I get to blame other people. I don't have to do anything. I just get to say, right. Hey, everybody else, figure this out. So is it a kind of thing where we need to vote with our dollar somehow? Or is this a government fix? What do you think?
I don't think it's a government fix. We do have bad agricultural policies, but they don't cause bad agriculture. They just kind of let people who are, you know, not great at it keep being in the business. It doesn't make people do it badly. And that's another thing is I feel like the food movement's really emphasized like, oh, we need to fix policy. And I don't really think a lot of this is policy's fault, actually. It doesn't force people to do stuff wrong. I see so many people doing stuff right in spite of the policy that I just don't think policy is the issue. Again, it's just businesses getting their shit together. So, which is, I don't know if that's the answer anybody's ever looking for, but I really think it's a B2B problem. So like I mentioned, like the South could be and should be, I think in many ways, the breadbasket of the US. And it's just not. Like we grow stuff down here, but it's not a place where you think, oh yeah, you know, like the California Central Valley. It's not like that. But it could be and it should be. Like we're losing so much. You know, financial gains and human capital. And just, we're just losing so much in our region because we're not doing that. And a lot of that just kind of comes down to, you know, those are the businesses that operate down here and that's the culture. And the only way it's going to change is folks down here deciding to do it differently. I know that sounds hopeless, but I see so many people down here who are doing it differently. And I just kind of want to say, you know what, give them time, you know, let them do it.
Right. Yeah. It kind of gives the listener the impression that there's not really anything they should be doing.
Yeah.
Unless you own an agriculture business.
Yeah. The food movement has pushed the burden of fixing business problems onto the consumer. And I just don't think that's really appropriate. Like there's a certain amount of stuff you can do voting with your dollars, but all that does is create demand. It doesn't create fulfillment of that demand. So, you know, like the demand has been there for years and businesses just kind of need to get their shit together and fulfill it. And, you know, folks may not like that answer, but it just takes time. And if you really want to go all out, start your own business and actually educate yourself first and don't start a fucking craft brewery. Like the world has plenty of problems and there aren't enough brands of craft beer is not one of them. So
especially in Sacramento. Oh, my God.
I mean, craft beer is fine and all, but that's not like what the world is suffering from. Yeah. Right? So,
hey, people just want to drink beer. I think that's the.
Yeah. And then again, that's fine. It's like.
But craft breweries are not saving the environment.
They're really not. Yeah. So that's kind of the thing is like, I see a lot of folks kind of get into food entrepreneurship for really basically lifestyle related reasons. And they make a lot of noise about how they're saving the earth while they're at it. And you're like, no, this is just your hobby business. And that's okay if that's what you want to do. But please don't act like you're saving the world while you're doing it. You would be doing things very differently if that's what you were about.
Wow, this is strange. So, I don't know. Yeah, now I don't know what to do. Okay, well, I guess we just have to wait and hope you fix everything. I don't know. Hope somebody fixes it.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a big part of what I'm pivoting my business towards is I have been consulting towards folks who kind of already started their business. And it just kind of turns out that they've already made some key decisions about what they're doing and why. And there's not a whole lot that you can add as a consultant at that point. So I'm kind of pivoting into, you know, like podcasting. I'm writing a book. I just sent out the proposal today to an agent and just kind of getting the word out there that like, hey, businesses have a big role in this. So let's talk about how to achieve that. There's already been some great publications out there about how to do it. I think a lot of the answer is going to be actually people oriented. It's going to be businesses treating people right, because when you do that, a lot of other things fall into place.
Well, maybe I'm a big government liberal, but I just think that when it comes to making businesses do stuff that where the incentives aren't already lining up, that I feel like regulation is really the only instrument you have.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah. Like California, I think that's, you know, there are many pieces to why California is successful. And I think regulations is one of them. If you are going to farm in California, they have standards. And if you don't meet them, you're out. I think that has not been bad for California. You come out here to North Carolina where we have no standards and the farmers act like it, you know? And I think folks here are afraid to have regulations because they've been told that it drives business away. And you're like, listen, if that's how it worked, California, we'd be poor and we'd be rich.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But in terms of just like the demand is already there, like the demand's already there. Businesses already have every incentive in the world to do things a certain way, and they're just not doing them. So it's not like passing laws is going to do anything, at least not out here, because like enforcement agencies are terrified to actually enforce laws. A lot of it is just, again, businesses getting their shit together. And for me, my part in that, I think, is just kind of getting the word out that there is such a thing as businesses having their shit together. Because I think the reason they get away with not doing that is just because folks don't know any better. Hmm. So again, we focus so much on the environmental part and not on the people part. And I think once you do the people part, everything else falls into place. So let's talk about that.
All right. Well, that's a great time to talk about your podcast, Farm to Tabor. As we mentioned, you mentioned you've got some book proposals out. Is there anything else you want to plug while we're at it?
That's it for now. I've got a Twitter, but if you're listening to this, you may have found it already. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I'll certainly tag you. Yeah.
Yeah. What the podcast is, Farm to Tabor. It's on iTunes now, which is very exciting. Yeah. And it's
a big time. All right, Dr. Sarah Tabor, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it so much. And check out the podcast, everybody.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank my guest. It was very fascinating. I learned a lot. I gotta say, I'm still a little skeptical on whether or not, you know, government can help solve some of these things. Seems like when you need businesses to do something, as I already mentioned on the show, I guess, and consumers aren't quite able to make that happen, seems like regulation is the way to go. But she's the expert, and I don't know, maybe there's more to look into that. I do totally agree that there's too much burden placed on the individual with things like this. And that we really, when it comes to certain issues, some issues, you know, maybe we can do something if we all put our minds together, if we all change our behavior as consumers. But when it comes to like water usage and things like this, where businesses are really the ones doing all of it, you know, like really doing the lion's share, 90-95%, there's not much we can do as individuals. Of course, we can try to advocate for public policy or vote with our dollars. But I do think a lot of the stress, a lot of social stress is put on to people and parents and stuff when it comes to food. And I think maybe some of that's unfair. And I thought Sarah's insights on that were right on and really fascinating. So, all right, well, that's the show. Hey, please support the show. Go to patreon.com/seriouspod. Join the ranks of people who make this show happen. And of course, gain access to bonus stuff from time to time. Also, seriouspod.com/support is another way you can go. Seems as though Patreon has figured their stuff out for now. I can't believe they scared the bejesus out of us. I guess it's almost been a year. It's been 9 months ago with those whole changes. And they guess they got gun shy and never really did anything. So Patreon for now seems to be a good way to go as well. But either way, if you want to make the show happen, that's how you can do it. And also, another thing you can do is tell someone about the show if you found an episode interesting and call in to that voicemail number. A couple weeks now, we'll have another voicemail episode. And that's when I get to get an indication of what is capturing your interest, what things you might want to hear more about, what things you might want to hear more interviews about. Always open to those kinds of emails and tips and comments and voicemails. So, all right, well, that's it for me. I will see you guys next week.